Well, good evening, everybody. I'm going to read here in just a moment from Romans chapter 1. And if you'd like to turn your Bible there to read with me tonight, I'd invite you to do so. as you turn to Romans 1, I would like to ask for your prayers tonight for my father-in-law, whose name is Bob Bennett. He has found out that he has a heart murmur, and tomorrow they're going to do a procedure to try to correct it. It's not as invasive as the old-fashioned form of valve replacement and repair, but it's still significant. He's 81 years old, so anytime you have a procedure, especially when you have a little mileage on you, it's a worrisome thing. So if you could keep him in mind tomorrow, we would sure appreciate it. I wanted to read a little bit here from Romans chapter 1. At verse 18, Paul says, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." Well, what truth does Paul have in mind? Well, the most basic truth of all, verse 19. "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived." And how has this truth been perceived? "Ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. And so," Paul says, "they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds, and animals, and creeping things." Now, what Paul says here is striking. Number one, he says that through creation, the existence and even the attributes of God are clearly seen. So that if you don't believe in God, you're accountable simply because of what we can observe in nature. But secondly, Paul says there are some people who have chosen to deliberately suppress that truth, try to keep it under wraps. And in fact, what he says they have done is they have made a horrible and terrible exchange. Rather than seeing God as the Creator, as the ultimate reality, they have chosen to see the creation, animals, birds, reptiles, and even mankind himself in the form of idolatry as the ultimate reality. Well, as was announced last night, what I want to talk with you about tonight is dealing with unbelief in an age of skepticism. And I don't think anybody would dispute that we are now entering a grave age of skepticism. Just to give you one simple poll that illustrates this, I realize there's a lot of different kinds of lines on here. Some of them are solid, some of them are dotted, some of them are mixed. But here's what this chart is showing us. On the far left-hand side, 1972, on the far right-hand side, 2014. What these lines are showing us are various forms of unbelief. And you don't have to make them out individually to see, they're all going the wrong direction. They're all increasing. Just for example, the dark solid line represents those who claim no religious affiliation. In 1972, just a few years after I was born, that represented only 10% of people aged 18 to 29. But now, in 2014, according to this survey, over 30% of 18 to 29-year-olds have no religious identification. Another one of these lines, it's a little bit harder to distinguish, but it's the line that's kind of a broken and then dotted line, represents those who claim they never pray. And in 2014, that was 30%. Now, you consider this. We all know about the proverbial atheist in the foxhole who prays. There are even unbelievers who, in a time of crisis, will periodically pray. But of 18 to 29-year-olds, 30% say they never even do that, much less bother to go to church once a year. And most of them are claiming, according to this poll, 33% or so, of those represented on this poll that they have no religious affiliation whatsoever. And if these numbers create any kind of trend, we can only imagine what the next 30 or so years are going to look like. Now, you may also notice that there are a couple of spots on this chart where the numbers spike. And I just drew a vertical line at one of those marks. As you can see to the right-hand side of that red line, these numbers sharply go up. That line reflects the year 2001. Can you think of anything that happened in 2001 that may have helped to spur on unbelief? Well, of course, it's the terrible attack that took place on 9/11. And you might be thinking, well, what connection does that have with the rise of unbelief? Well, think of this line of logic. 9/11 was an attack by Islamic radicals. For some people, there's no difference between Islamic radicals and Muslims generally. For other people, there's no difference between Muslims and all religious people. And so do you see how it's just a few steps of checkers to say what 9/11 shows us is not that Islam is flawed, that religion itself is flawed. And that is the reason that the cottage industry of books, like Christopher Hitchens' bestseller, God Is Not Great, came out after 9/11. Because these writers decided to capitalize on the way that they thought they could somehow stereotype all religion as violent. In fact, I don't know if you can make this out, but the subtitle of his book is How Religion Poisons Everything. And that's what his basic belief was. It's not Islamic radicalism that's the problem, it's religion, period, that is the problem. But I don't think that 9/11 is the primary contributor to why unbelief is on the rise so much. I think there's another more fundamental reason, and that fundamental reason has to do with technology. We live in an age, especially in the last 20 years, where technology enables us to do amazing things. Over on the chair I have my phone. And I'm hesitant to talk about my phone because once this year while I was preaching, my phone thought I was talking to it and it started talking back to me. It was pretty embarrassing, especially because I had taught my phone to call me Galactic Overlord, and that's how she referred to me in the entire public assembly. When I bought my first computer in 1989, that computer had a 20 megabyte hard drive, 20 megabytes, and the guy who sold it to me told me, you'll probably never need any more than that. And now my phone, if you're not a tech nerd, just hang in there for a minute here, okay? But my phone is a 64 gigabyte phone. I mean, it just dwarfs what my computer could do back in 1989. And so for some people, the fact that science has given us such great technological advances must mean that maybe science has the answer to everything. And so, there's a professor named Alex Rosenberg who's written a book called The Atheist's Guide to Reality, in which he argues this very point. He says this in his book, that it's not just simply science we can be confident in, but it's something called scientism. What is scientism? Scientism, he says, is the conviction that the methods of science are the only reliable ways to secure knowledge of anything. In other words, because science has shown us so much truth in technology, that pretty much guarantees us that science has all the answers to everything, and if science has all the answers to everything, why do we need religion? He says this as well in his book. The technological success of physics is by itself enough to convince anyone with anxiety about scientism that if physics isn't finished, it certainly has the broad outlines of reality well understood. In other words, we pretty much can expect physics and science are going to answer all of our questions eventually. Now, before I go on, I want to make sure everybody understands the difference between science, which is a noble pursuit, and scientism, which is the belief that science has all the answers to all questions. Here's the difference between the two. Science and physics can give us equations like this, which I put up because it's the only physics equation I know. All right, E equals mc squared. Don't ask me to tell you what these letters mean, but at least I know that there's that equation. Now, that's Einstein's theory of relativity, and it was crucial to the development of atomic energy. Physics and science can give us equations like that. But can physics tell us anything about whether or not it is moral to use a bomb that employs the atomic power represented by this equation? What physics textbook, what calculator is going to tell us whether the use of an atomic bomb is right or wrong? See, physics can't answer that question. So the fundamental mistake that unbelievers are making is the assumption that because science can answer some questions, therefore science can answer all questions. That's scientism. It would be tantamount to a man who takes a metal detector out to the beach, out here to the Gulf, and finds a lot of metal objects and assumes because his metal detector is so good at finding metal objects, that must mean all that's on the beach are metal objects. Well, no, your metal detector's great at finding metal, but there's a lot else on the beach besides metal. Science and physics are great at figuring out science and physics questions. But the assumption is that's all there is. So here's what I want to do tonight. Tonight's lesson will be a little bit different. Yesterday morning and yesterday evening, I did what I most like to do as a preacher. We just took the Bible, opened it up to a passage, and I went through and dug out everything I could find in there to give to you. Tonight's lesson is going to be a little bit different. Tonight's lesson is more like Paul going to Athens, where Paul could go to the Athenian philosophers and use their own writings and their own philosophy and show them the ultimate failure of their philosophy and point them toward God. What I ask is for you to hang in there with me tonight as we do the very same thing. And I've given you a handout tonight to kind of follow along step by step as we talk about some problems. I want to tell you this. I've had many conversations with unbelievers, including young people who were Christians who have lost their faith. And this issue of scientism is the heart of the issue for why they're losing their faith or they are rejecting faith. And so the way I look at it is, if we're going to deal with the problem of unbelief, we might as well just take it on head on. And that's what I want to do tonight. Now, here is the first point that I want you to consider with me tonight. Atheists like Professor Rosenberg say that science is the only form of reliable knowledge. The conviction that the methods of science are the only reliable ways to secure the knowledge of anything. So here would be my first question to this writer. Can you secure the knowledge that science is the only reliable way to know anything? Can you secure that knowledge by science itself? What math equation, what physics equation is he going to give us that proves that science is the only reliable way to know anything? Do you understand that when somebody says that, they are making a claim that is not a scientific claim? They are making a philosophical claim. And if the belief is that science is the only reliable form of knowledge, but you can't prove that by science, then what you have done is cut the limb off that you're sitting on. And so the first thing I would say to you is this. Scientism as a belief is self-refuting. Because since you can't prove this by the scientific method, and the only form of proof you could give to assure us that this is the case is non-scientific, then you've admitted there are more ways to know the truth about something than by science. Everybody get that point? Now, there's no point in me going on tonight. And listen, I've got all kinds of time. They gave me a fan tonight, so I'm ready to rock and roll all night long, all right? So there's no point going on unless we get this one down, all right? If you say science has all the answers, but science can't answer your fundamental belief, you've cut the limb off you're sitting on. All right, that's point number one. And that would be bad enough. We have already established that the fundamental claim behind atheism cannot support itself. But it gets much worse. And here's how it gets much worse. The reason that people like Rosenberg say that physics has all the answers is because he believes all that exists are lumps of stuff, matter. And the equations of physics can refine and delineate lumps of stuff, and so therefore physics must have all the answers. But here is the problem with this. Physics uses math, which uses numbers. So I want you to think with me here for just a second. I should have gotten a marker to do this tonight. If I took a piece of paper and I wrote the number 2 on it, and I tore that piece of paper up, think with me carefully. Have I destroyed the number 2? No. What if I went through the building to every songbook and scratched out every numeral 2 in every songbook and Bible? Would I have destroyed the number 2? What if I went around the world on a crazy crusade and eliminated every written form of the number 2? Have I eliminated the number 2? No. Why not? Because numbers aren't concrete objects. They're abstract objects. If I got rid of every printed number 2 in every language everywhere on the planet, would 2 plus 2 still equal 4? Yeah. And that's because numbers are abstract. They're not concrete objects. Now, I want you to think with me about this for just a second. What people like this say is that all that exists are lumps of stuff that can be mathematically quantified by physics. But as we've just said, physics and mathematics rely on numbers. But numbers are not lumps of stuff. They're abstract objects. Which means that in order to do physics, you have to believe that something more than just lumps of stuff exist, like abstract objects like numbers. You follow me? But if you believe that, then all that exists can't be lumps of stuff. Do we have any math teachers in the audience? Well, that explains why this point has just gotten all the hallelujah. Ah, there's one back there in the back. All right. But the point is, if you think physics has all the answers, because all there is stuff you can put your hands on, but you have to rely on numbers, which by definition aren't lumps of stuff, they're abstract objects, then you couldn't even do physics by this line of thinking. And so physics doesn't exist. That's the second major problem with the heart of atheism. And that would be enough for us to stop tonight. But we're going to go on, because there's even something that makes this that much worse. Here is a quote from the book that Rosenberg wrote. Individual human life is meaningless without a purpose and without ultimate moral value. So in other words, think about it like this. Do lumps of stuff have any purpose to them? If I came over here to this fine pulpit, this is a really pretty pulpit, and I said, block of wood, what is your purpose in life? Would it respond? Of course not, because mere lumps of stuff have no purpose. But if, according to the atheist guide to reality, that's all that exists, that means you and me are just lumps of stuff. So then if I were to ask you what is your purpose in life, you have no more purpose in life, according to this view, than this lump of wood could say that it has. And so the problem is then, what do you have left in this view of the world that gives you any meaning or purpose? Well, all he can say in the book is a nice sort of, this is not a word we use a lot, nihilism. You want to know what this word means? You ever heard this song, I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me? That's what that means. If you were to ask him, what is your purpose in life? All he could tell you is, I have no purpose, because all I am is a lump of stuff. So that means, according to atheism, there is no meaning or purpose to life. But it gets even worse than this. Consider this. Here's a beautiful diagram of a brain. And here is a picture of one of my favorite thinkers. And he's contemplating one of my very favorite thoughts. I contemplated this same thought this morning at Rao's Bakery. That's a pretty nice play. I may not leave Port Arthur just so I can keep going to Rao's. Now, if you believe that all that exists are lumps of stuff, then you don't believe that you have a brain, but you also have a mind that thinks. If all you are is a lump of stuff, then really all your mind is just your brain. Now think about what that means. Since the mind is just the brain, then according to what Rosenberg says in his book, every state of your brain is fixed by physical laws. Just like the law of gravity says what goes up must come down, the laws of physics determine everything. So in other words, you think you have a mind. You don't have a mind. All you have is a brain, a lump of stuff, subject to the laws of physics. Which means you're not choosing to think about anything right now. The laws of physics are at work on your brain, and they're making you have sensations that you think are thoughts. And so since you can't choose what you're going to do, the laws of physics are making you do it, you don't have any free will. You didn't choose to come here tonight. The laws of physics made you come here tonight. But it gets even worse than this. And here's how it gets worse. Why do we punish criminals? We punish criminals because we believe they've done something wrong. Well, why do we punish them for doing something wrong? Because we believe they could have chosen differently. But if they had no choice, because there is no free will to make choices, because they were simply doing what the laws of physics made them do, how could we reasonably punish them for doing what is wrong? They didn't choose to do it. Well, Rosenberg has an answer to this in his book. And the answer is, there's no right and wrong anyway. How could there be if all we are lumps of stuff? And so he says that his view rejects the distinction between acts that are morally permitted, forbidden or required, claims that they're all based on false, groundless presuppositions. Now you might think, well, wait a minute, surely he would be willing to say that what Adolf Hitler did was wrong. Nihilism, remember, I got plenty of nothing, nothing's plenty for me, that means no free will, it means no right and wrong. I can't condemn Hitler, Stalin. His view, he says, seems to cut that ground out from under us. And he says, we can't avoid this by the view of scientism. We just got to make the best of it. Now, a moment ago when I was making points like, you can't have physics because you can't have numbers, that might have seemed esoteric. But you see how serious this starts to get. When you say that people have no purpose, there's no meaning to life, that there's no free will, because there's no right or wrong. You see how serious this starts to get. I was curious because later in his book, he talked about the Nazis a little bit more. He says, outside of the psychopaths among them, he says the Nazis were right to think to a large extent they shared our core morality. It was their wildly false factual beliefs that led to the moral catastrophe. In other words, here's what he's saying. There were some crazy dudes among the Nazis. But the biggest problem is, some of them just had factually wrong beliefs. Except, according to his view of the world, how do any of us have any beliefs? Remember, we're all just stuff. And according to his view, the things that we think we believe are simply the product of random chance, of evolution. Now let me ask you this question. How good could evolution be at telling us what is true and false? I'll use an illustration here. I learned when I was in school, we learned this in science, that through genetics, some people have attached earlobes and some people have detached earlobes. Look at your neighbor. Everybody always feels their own. Can you look around and see if your neighbor has attached or detached? You know what I'm talking about? Now, mine are attached. Did any of you notice, or yours detached? Any of yours like hang flop loose a little bit here? Anybody do that? All right, now, would this statement make any sense? My earlobe is right and your earlobe is wrong. Doesn't make any sense, does it? I'm blue-eyed. My wife is brown-eyed. Could I say my eyes are right and yours wrong? See, it doesn't make any sense, does it? Because that's just the genetic dice roll. Well, according to his view of the world, that's what all of us think. It's just a product of random chance. And later in his book, he says this. And remember, what I'm doing tonight is I'm taking his writing and pointing out here's what its consequences are. So he says this. There's lots of evidence that natural selection is not very good at picking out true beliefs. There are lots of moral values and ethical norms enlightened people reject, but Mother Nature is strongly selected for. And then he says two of them are racism and xenophobia, the fear of strangers. Now that sounds like highfalutin language. You know what he's saying in this book? What he's saying is that evolution predisposes us to fear people who look differently than us and perceive them as threats. And he says, really, that's to your advantage to be a little bit paranoid to survive. Well, wait a minute. How else could you better describe the beliefs of Nazis than as racism and xenophobia? So how can you say they have false beliefs when you're now telling us, well, actually, these are the beliefs that nature suggests are true beliefs? Is that your view of the world? Let me ask you this question. How many people do you know who are unbelievers who realize that's where their view of the world will take them? I had a stunning exchange with friends of mine on Facebook this summer because of this terrible story, this gorilla, Harambe. I have a lot of friends I have a hobby of singing in a barbershop quartet, so I make a lot of friends who come from a very different line of thought than I do. So I decided to have a little discussion on Facebook. So I asked my unbelieving friends this question. I said, you know, this terrible tragedy where the Cincinnati zookeepers felt like they had to choose between the life of a little boy and the life of this gorilla, and they chose the life of the boy over the gorilla. And I said to them, now I know how I would explain that. I believe there's a God. God has made mankind in His image, and human life is therefore sacred and more valuable than animal life. That's how I would explain it. But you don't believe in God, so I'm curious, how would you explain how it was justifiable to save this boy's life? The answers astonished me. What several of my friends said is this. There was no inherent reason to say that the boy's life was more valuable. What they said is, as one of my friends said, the only obligations that seem to exist are within one's own tribe. We're on the human tribe. Harambe was on the gorilla tribe, so we go with our tribe. And I said, well, I appreciate your honesty, but now I've got to ask a follow-up question. The Nazis said they were defending their tribe, and they were eliminating enemies from other tribes on the basis of what you've just told me. How would you condemn what they did? I was mortified that at the end of that discussion, only a couple of my atheist or agnostic friends could come up with any justification. So I want you to see what the consequences are when you have a view that says all that exists are lumps of stuff that you can study in physics equations. Tell me why it is that you should save a human life. One of my friends who's an unbeliever eventually said, well, it's just tribal. And I said, well, okay. You know, there are some tribes in the world right now where they sell little girls into sex trade. That's what their culture says is right. You're telling me all morality is cultural and tribal. Tell me why that's wrong. You know what her answer was? I guess I haven't studied enough philosophy. You're going to have a philosophy class to know you don't sell little girls into sex trade. Let's get real about this. So I want you to understand, here is the problem. There are a lot of younger people who have decided to become agnostic or atheist because for whatever reasons they think it's so hip and so bright and so smart and so cool, and it is time to bring people to confront what the consequences of that system of thinking leads to. And if you can't come up with an answer for why to save a little boy's life instead of a gorilla's, may I suggest your view of the world is fundamentally wrong. Now, this would be bad enough. The morality doesn't exist. But guess what? Oh, it gets much worse. And you're thinking, well, how could it get much worse? Remember I showed you this picture a moment ago? Homer contemplating a sprinkled donut. If the mind is just simply your brain, a physical organ, that means your mind is just a lump of stuff. Question. Is there any fundamental difference then between Homer Simpson's mind and that donut? No. Nor is there any difference between your mind and a donut. Which leads to this next question. What does a donut think about? And the answer is, it doesn't, because it's just a lump of stuff. Well, guess what? If that's all the mind is, can it really think? Now, I know this is going to sound crazy. You're not going to believe somebody would really say this. But here's what Rosenberg says in his book. How can one clump of stuff in the universe be about some other clump of stuff anywhere else in the universe? And his answer, it can't. He says, our brains are just like a computer. You can put information in a computer and you can bring it out, but what's your computer thinking about? He says, so when our consciousness assures us that we have thoughts about stuff, it has to be wrong. The brain non-consciously stores information in thoughts, but thoughts are not about stuff. Right now, you're not having any thoughts. You think you are. Well, you can't be doing that, can you? You're not having any thoughts. So this makes me want to ask Professor Rosenberg this question. Hey, Professor Rosenberg, what is your book about? And then if he starts to tell me, I would say, are you expressing your thoughts? And as soon as he says that, I'll say, you don't have any. And so at the end of the day, what is his book about? What's the only answer? I got plenty of nothing and nothing's plenty for right. It's nothing. Because there is no such thing as thoughts. Now you're thinking, well, that's got to be it. That's got to be the end of the story. Thinking doesn't exist, the end. Guess what? It gets even worse than that. Look again carefully at this quote down at the bottom. The brain non-consciously stores. This is going to sound so bizarre, but you need to understand that his view, the view that all that exists are lumps of stuff, means not merely that you may not be thinking right now. It means there isn't even any such thing as consciousness itself. Now, I'm looking around the room and I applaud you because most of you appear to still be conscious right now in this lesson. Well, what does that mean? Here's what he says. There is no self, soul, person. Scientism must firmly deny its existence. The self as conveyed to us by introspection is a fiction. It doesn't exist. So let me illustrate what's going on here. How many of you have ever seen one of these charts? Any of y'all ever seen one of these charts? All right. I have a bum knee, so I periodically go to the orthopedist and, you know, they'll ask you. So for those of you who don't know what this is, when you go to the hospital or a clinic, they want to assess your pain level. And they always use these ridiculous-looking frowny faces and smiley faces. Now, consider this. They can take a machine and hook it up to you and measure certain physical properties. They can tell you what your blood pressure is. They can tell you what your heart rate is. They can do an x-ray and tell you what your knee looks like. They can do an x-ray and look at your cavities. They can do all kinds of things like that. But they can't hook up a machine and tell you how much pain you're in. You know why not? Because that pain is not a physical thing that can be quantified like your weight or blood pressure. Your pain is a reflection of your inner consciousness. So that's why they can measure everything else physically, but they have to ask you, how much pain are you in? But if you don't believe there's consciousness, can you really have pain? One guy actually wrote this. He says, the absurdity of saying nobody has ever felt pain is no greater than saying, well, nobody's ever seen a demon. So he says this, next time you go to the hospital or doctor and they ask you how much pain you're in, it would be helpful if you would just say, my C fibers are firing. Now, can you imagine that our friendly dentist over here, you go to see him because you've got a bum tooth, and you say, my tooth is killing me. And he goes, no, I'm not concerned about that. All I want to know is, are your C fibers firing? Probably would not be the recipe for a very successful practice. I certainly wouldn't want that nurse or that dentist to be the one working on me. So do you see that according to this way of thinking, the conscious self does not exist? But it gets even worse than that. Well, what's left? Remember I said to you that scientism in a lot of ways is based on the confidence we have in our use of technology and science for predictions about the future and then inventing things. And of course, as you've already seen, Rosenberg talks a lot about evolution, which is our study of the past to allegedly determine how we got here today. But if you have no consciousness, then can you even really think about the past or make predictions about the future? He says science must deny the basic notion that we ever really think about the past and the future. Well, wait a minute. If scientism is based on evolution, a study of the past, but we can't know the past because our brains can't think about it, and if evolution is based on scientism, which is based on predictions about the future, but our brain can't do that, then what's left to prove scientism? And the answer is nothing. So that means that scientism itself has no basis to exist. I've got one more for you. Can I give you one more? It gets much worse. Here it is. The subtitle of his book is Enjoying Life Without Illusion. I don't know if you can see that. And the reason he called it that is because he's saying things like consciousness, thinking, free will, morality, those are illusions. That's his favorite word in the book. He says this, look, if I'm going to get scientism into your skull, I have to use the only tools we've got for making information, moving information from one head to another, ink marks, blotches, pixels, etc. But it's all just an illusion. So when you read his book and you're thinking that I'm learning from his thoughts, it's all just an illusion. So we have a young man who's the son of one of our members who had a chance to take a trip to Italy. And he did the thing, have you all ever seen pictures like this, where you go in front of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and you position yourself as someone with a camera, and you put your hands up so it makes you look like you're holding it up. You ever seen anybody do that? Creates kind of an illusion. Now, why do we know that's an illusion? The reason we know it's an illusion is because we know what the reality is. Namely, no man could hold the Leaning Tower of Pisa up by himself. So do you understand that you can't talk about things as an illusion if those things don't also exist in reality? Like, would it make any sense for me to talk about a counterfeit dollar bill if we didn't know there were real dollar bills? So if that's the case, the only way you could talk about free will, consciousness, thinking and morality as an illusion, as if the real thing existed. Which means even the subtitle of his book is complete nonsense. Now then, I want to say, give you one final illustration tonight to try to pull all of this together. And again, remember the purpose tonight was to simply take an atheist philosopher view of the world and show what its consequences are. When I was in the third grade, I was sitting at a table with some other students, and we were trying to color something, and John Brooks had the crayons, and I wanted them, and he wouldn't give them to me, and I started to wring his neck. It was not a highlight of my life, but it happened. I mean, all I can tell you is, give me the crayons if I ask for them, all right? So, I guess that's the thing. All right, so, now I'm an adult, and I'm thinking about whether I should have done that. So I want you to look at this statement very carefully. I am reflecting on whether I should have chosen to cause pain to John Brooks to get the colored crayons. I think it's a good thing for me to consider that. I don't want to wring anybody's neck here this week if I can help it. So I'm trying to contemplate this. But I want you to consider that if the world, according to this book, Rosenberg's book, is true, how much of that statement even makes any sense? For example, remember we said that according to his view of the world, there's no such thing as right and wrong. That means there's no such thing as should and should not have. So we can just scratch those right off the list. But remember also, what he said is there is no such thing as conscious reflection of free will, of choices. And so we can scratch choosing off of the list. And then, of course, since we don't have conscious thought, we can't intend to do things. So any to statement, I had to scratch it off the list. So to cause and to get just has no meaning. It's gibberish, according to his view of the world. You following me? Well, what else do I need to scratch off of here? Well, if there's no such thing as conscious thought, I certainly can't reflect on anything, so I scratched reflecting off of that statement. And then you remember he said that consciousness is what gives us our sensation of pain. It would also give us the sensation of things like color, but that doesn't exist, so I just scratched off pain and color. Everybody see that? What else has to go here? We remember when he said there's no such thing as the conscious self? Who is there to reflect on this? Nobody. And who is there to reflect about? Nobody. So I just scratched off me and John Brooks. Ladies and gentlemen, according to atheism, all that exists are colorless crayons. That's the view of the world. Do you think something like this might be why Paul said, professing to be wise, they became fools? Because what the ancient pagans said at the end of the day is, the ultimate morality is stuff. Animals, sun, moon, and stars, people, so that's what we'll worship. And at the end of the day, what has he said? The ultimate final reality is just stuff. And the great irony is, if that's true, there's no him to even think it or really try to convince us. Because none of those things exist. My purpose tonight has simply been to help us to understand in a series of steps how to force people to confront what the consequences of this kind of unbelief are. This isn't just my thought, by the way. One of the world's most highly regarded atheists is a man named Thomas Nagel, who has written this about his book called Mind and Cosmos. He says, it's impossible to think that purely physical processes can explain the existence of the conscious mind. Now then, I have this question. Why is he still an atheist? If he's willing to admit this. And he's written about why he is an atheist. In his book called The Last Word, he says this: it isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope I'm right. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. Have you ever heard somebody accuse you as a Christian of just simply relying on wishful thinking? I don't know about you, that sounds a lot like wishful thinking to me. Here's what I wish the world was like. In other words, what Paul said in Romans 1 is there are people who suppress the truth because they don't want to have to live accountably under that truth. And our hope certainly is that tonight there is no one here of that mind. That you would see everything that we've talked about tonight, which shows the folly of the view of the world that excludes God, also argues to the presence of God. And that you would want to live under His eternal love, which we invite you to do tonight, if you will choose to trust and obey while we stand and sing together.